This interview with Andrea Harrison was recorded on March 31st, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
I think coming up as a young lady, I was very inquisitive, energetic. I loved life. I always welcomed challenges. I'll just say that. I remember being middle age. I guess I was in middle school. I had this T-shirt that said, "Girls can do anything, boys can do them better." So that was just something that I began to believe. And so that helped me to compete in all aspects of my professional career as I was starting that, and as well as just in my personal life. Second part of that question, I guess I would say, you know, life shows up for us, and the challenges that come with life sometimes make us feel like we don't have many options. And during the time when I consciously made the decision to break the law, one side of my mind said, well, you know, you don't have any other options. You can't get a loan. You don't want to go rob somebody. So this is the safest way to get out of this debt and get out of this hole that I was in. Working at NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center. And I had started out there a GS-5, I think it was, which that's just their pay scale. It's a general service level 5. And when I resigned, I was a GS-13. So I had worked my way up, needless to say, broke barriers, went from a paraprofessional to a professional. So early on in that career leap, I guess I was maybe a GS-5. We had gotten some additional responsibilities. I worked in training and development department. Mm-hmm. We had gotten some responsibilities where we could be contracting officers, where we would write contracts for vendors that would come and do training at NASA. So as a part of the team to develop that, I had to come up with some policies and some regulations for the staff. And I made some suggestions at the time, wasn't thinking about committing fraud. And the suggestions were, you know, these are some things that we can do to prevent people from committing fraud. And so I took the document that I created, and I met with our HR director, who was my supervisor. And I was like, you know, several of the administrative, I forget what our title was at the time. I have to think of. Training specialists. We were training specialists. I said, they're going to be responsible for these contracts. You know, I really think we need to have 3 checkpoints. And I was the final sign-off person on all of the contracts. So there are 5 staff that were going to be reviewing contracts and approving them. So anyway, I made the recommendations. These are the things that we can do. Triple checking, everything, whatever. Mm-hmm. He politely said to me, no, we're not going to do that. That's not going to be needed. You'll review. This is a process. I'll review if needed, you know, as long as everything's fine, everything's fine. We're not going to do it. So I walk away. You know, I was still, again, young in my career. And I was like, making up all these stories in my head. Like, why did he take it? Does he think I'm not smart enough? You know, this white man won't take this suggestion from this black woman. That came across my mind. And then I was just like, okay, well, whatever. Don't worry about it. You made the suggestion and it is what it is. So I proceed to work and we train and we do. Had gotten a promotion, still, you know, working, had a challenge in my life, had a death in the family, and something else happened. And it was just a lot going on. Car broke down. Let me back up a little bit. I was a teen mother, had my daughter at the age of 16. And so that was a challenge of itself. Car broke down. That's an hour drive, 45 minutes an hour both ways. I was living in Baltimore. Eventually I bought a house in Towson when I was 25. So anyway, I had purchased my house. So I had to be 25 at the time. And it was just a lot going on, not enough money to meet bills. And I describe it as this. There is for me, I actually did a whole training set about money and money addiction as a result of this. So the way I explain it is there's this voice, the good voice and the evil voice. The evil voice said, well, you know, you could write a contract and all your troubles would go away. Because, you know, there are no checkpoints and you're the signator and you just got to find somebody to give you the money once you do the contract. Good voice said, girl, you know, you don't want to do that. That's not right. You know, that's not legal. It's not ethical. What if you get caught? Thoughts go away. I keep chugging along, stuff keeps piling up. And then the bad voice won. As the Fed said, I was a very smart criminal until I got caught. So I had to find somebody who was going to be that person that I could trust, right, to tell them what my plan was and to give me all the money. The one that I found, I met with my friend, and he was a friend I met in when I was going to college. And I told him what my thought was, and he was like, okay, I'm down, whatever. You know, I'll help a sister out. I was like, you sure? If anything happens, you know, I'll take the fall, but I gotta do it. It's gonna work. There's no way it's not gonna work. So at the time when I committed the fraud, I was not making the money that I was making when I resigned. So when this crime went on, I was at the GS-5-6 level. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, might have been $25,000. And so we're talking about back in the 80s, early 90s. It wasn't a lot. I was a homeowner. I owned my first house. It was built new in Towson. So I had a lot of debt. And so I remember having $20 left after I paid everything with gas and all of that. So it was just tight. I wasn't a frivolous spender. Or anything like that. You know, the whole cycle of not having good credit. If you don't have good credit, then you can't get a loan, right, to even consolidate your debt. But then you're getting the debt so that you can, you know, pay things off or have your basic needs, you know, met. My daughter's father wasn't, he was incarcerated until she was 6 years old. So there was no child support. There was no real financial help from, you know, him or his family. It was provided for my family. It was pay for the funeral. Mm. It was make sure, you know, my car was right and my daughter was straight. But it was really it started out that way, right? But then that bug, when you get away with it, it's like, oh, give me more. And so the bug got me, right? So at first it was like, I'm going to do it this one time and I'm going to be done. But it turned out to not be one time. So the first real thought was like, oh, it worked. It worked like I had planned it to work. Like there was no checkpoint. There was no way that it wasn't going to work. And so I was like, okay, you know, I'm not going to do it anymore. And then months, maybe a year later, something else happened. And then the voice popped up and said, oh, you can do another contract. So I don't know the exact number of contracts, right? But I'll say this. My charge was for $247,000, $290,000. Mm-hmm. It went off and on over a period of 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I stopped. By the time I reached that GS-11 level, I was making sufficient money, didn't need to do it anymore. So GS-11, 12, 13, I was at NASA for a total of 14 years mm-hmm. Before I resigned. So it may have gone on for maybe 3 years. I resigned as a result. So how we got caught was my co-conspirator, right? Uh-huh. So time had gone on. Like I said, years had gone past. My co-conspirator calls me and says, hey, I want you to do me a favor. And we met, and he worked for Social Security. This is how I truly believe we got caught. Because up until then, like I said, years had passed. There was nothing. I continued to get promotions. There was no issues. So he calls me and he says, hey, I work for Social Security. I'm going to, you know, similar to what you did, it's not a contract, but you're going to be a payee on a check. And the check's going to come. It's going to have your name on it and someone else's name. And so, like, I didn't need to do it. I was like, how much money you need? I can lend you the money. Like, what? We don't have to do that anymore. Like, come on. And so he was persistent. And so then a part of me felt like, well, shit, he helped me do that all that time. It's the least I can do. Dumb me. And then the first check came. It was for $2,500. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And before he did it, I asked him, I said, are you sure? Are you the beginning and the end of this process? Are you sure that, you know, this can ride? Because, you know, like, you got to know the ins and outs of your system. Like, my system was tight. I knew, you know, who was looking at what and how to formulate documents and all of that. Like, are you on it, brother? And he was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, you sure? None of these people are going to be dead. Like, you know, nothing's going to trigger. You don't work in that department. Like, I was like, CSI criminal minds all in one. Like, do not screw this up. And, you know, he said, yeah. And I just went with it because I just, in my heart, I felt, you know, he did it for me. It's the least I can do. Let me just do it and get it over with.
Yeah.
We got two checks in. The second check, I was literally in the bank. And I'm a spiritual woman, so.
I understand.
So the notion came over me that this is it. It's over. You get ready to get caught.
You were in the bank when you got this feeling.
I was in the bank. So I go to the teller anyway, and she asks me a question or says something. And I say, okay, thank you. I take the check and I leave. I'm sitting in the car. Again, the spirit says, it's over. I tear up the check. I call him on the phone. I was like, hey, you know what? It's not working out. I'll meet you. I'll tell you, you know, whatever. So a third check comes, and the same thing. I tore the check up, and I just gave him the money. And then about 6 months after that, the feds came to my door and they had an indictment from Social Security for $5,000. The total of those checks were like $5,300.
Okay.
And so, you know, I acknowledged I knew him, acted like, you know, I didn't know what was going on. You know, so I go, they released me on my own recognizance. I obtained a lawyer. Had to end up getting a second lawyer. But at that point, I knew, right, if we were caught for Social Security, all it was going to take for them to go back and look at where I work and what I've done, you know, over the years, if they fully investigated, they were going to find some other stuff because his name was associated with some contracts that I had done. And then we waited and they came back with a second indictment. And at first we were, my second lawyer, we were in the room and they said, oh, you know, you embezzled or committed fraud on, you know, like $2.3 million. And so I laugh and I look at my attorney and I was like, as far as I'm concerned, this meeting is over. I was like, I may have signed $2.3 million in contracts, but I didn't steal them. If I did, I wouldn't be here. I was like, you guys are fishing and you're fishing wrong. So call me when you got the right amount. So my attorney was like, okay, let's go. They had to come to me with what they thought it was.
Right? Yeah.
And so that's the number that they chose to pick. And I was like, yeah, I signed that many contracts, but I didn't steal every contract that I signed. That's ridiculous. Yes, that is a federal charge. It's not a state charge. And so at one point in my mind, when this was going on early on, second or third, fourth contract, the voice says, you know, go big or go home. If you're going to do it, do it. If you're going to get caught for doing it something big. Don't get caught for doing something little. And I'm serious. Like, that was really the voice.
Yeah.
to see your name go across the television on the ticker tape saying federal indictment for NASA employee is, you know, not the news you want, but that's what it was. And so the federal system, I did get to pick the facility that I got to go to. So I went to Alderson, West Virginia. And I'm a research geek, so I did my research on all the facilities, and that seemed to be the most pleasant one if you're going to be incarcerated. We were in the mountains. There was no barbed wire fence around the facility. There was grass. They had a garden and a flower farm. When I got there, they had cottages where you would stay in the cottage versus the dorm, but the cottages were closed when I got there. But anyway. There were no cells, like jail cells. So they were like brick rooms, brick dorms, no door. Two people in the room. So that was the bigger difference. That's the privilege of committing a federal crime.
Okay.
I know that sometimes you can go to pick, like now with COVID, I know that our former mayor, Catherine Pugh, I'm in communication with her. She wanted to go to West Virginia, but she couldn't. So I don't know whether it was because of COVID or not. So she's in a very different federal facility. That's not, again, it's a tall structure. It's concrete. It's just a different environment. So I couldn't write a contract to myself. So I needed a person to pose as a business. He had to say that he was going to be doing business at NASA. And so say, for example, so when I did my test run to see if this was going to work, we had a vendor, I'll just call her Miss Cynthia. So Miss Cynthia did a workshop around the Myers-Briggs type indicator. She always did workshops for us on that. So I said, let me see if this will work. So during the time, we were still using typewriters. So her purchase order was for $5,600, right? For her to teach the class, that was the order, $5,600. Mm-hmm. So to see if my tests work, I said, I need to see if they're going to catch this. So I changed the six to an eight, $5,800, or 53, and I changed it to an eight, something like that.
Uh-huh.
When the invoice came to be paid, it said $5,800. Purchase order said $5,800. She got paid $5,800. So she called me on the phone. She said, hey, Andrea, I got an overpayment. I was only supposed to get thrifted $5,300. I was like, oh, don't worry about it. We'll take it off on the back end. So it worked. Mm-hmm. Only she knew that the amount wasn't what she had put on the original purchase order. So when my co-conspirator, like I said, there were many co-conspirators, but he was the only one because of the association with Social Security that they could link. He's still my dear friend.
Okay, that's good to know.
His mother hates me, but the judge says to me, I don't want to have to do this because I got a chance to say my piece in front of the judge and all, you know, make a, you know, explanation for what I'd done. And he said, I actually got what they call an unheard of sentence. So originally, anything over $200,000, it's 3 years. Incarceration, 3 years, two and a half years. He gave me what is called a split sentence. So I got the 2 years, but it was 15 months of incarceration and then 12 months home confinement with the ankle monitor. Just the fact that I did it, like, I'm just disappointed that I carried the whole thing out, right? That I acted on that thought that I knew was wrong because I knew better. So that to disappoint my family and the shame, you know, was huge. Was like, to this day, it's like, I won't break the law. I'm not taking anything that's not mine. I'm not doing anything. I'm never going back to prison. Like, no. My high school experience was excellent. I actually was able to go to a school that is no longer open. It was called Lawrence Paquin, and it was a school for pregnant teens at the time. And so I learned everything about being a young mom, and it was great. After that, I went to Western, and graduated from Western in 85. I worked in the gym, and so I taught people how to use the equipment in the gym. I had three jobs when I was in prison. So I worked at the gym, cleaning equipment, teaching people how to use the equipment, and then I taught exercise classes, aerobics, and it was before Zumba came out, but we were doing Zumba-like stuff. And then I worked in the education department where I had created a workshop called Money Makeover, looking at money as an addiction. And so I taught that class, and it actually replaced the pre-release class that they had there. And I taught that while I was there to all the women. I saw people that went, that left while I was in West Virginia and came back before I left. But I always say, you know, my lesson from this, and I've been working the repopulation since post-incarceration. So that's all I've done. And the rehabilitation starts at incarceration. You know, they say, oh, we're going to do reentry 3 months before you're released or 6 months before you're released. That's too late. And I don't care if, as long as you have an exit date, a date that you're going to be released, your reentry needs to start at day one. And it needs to be, to me, level based, the psychological, the academic, the, you know, and when I say psychological, I mean the emotional piece of that, all of that, mm-hmm. and the academic, and then your career, you know, what type of career, what type of job, what type of industry do you plan to acquire after you get home? You know, there was a time when they would make people do the GED. It was mandatory. Things were mandatory. Now it's optional. So if you give somebody something that's optional, and they had trouble in school, why am I going to keep going to school? I ain't got to go. I'm locked up. You know, mm-hmm. when, you know, you get three meals in a cot, you know, some people go there for that, to get shelter and three good meals. It's not that you want to go. It's not a want. It's, that's all I got right now. That's my best option. Cause I'm tired of sleeping on the street. I'm tired of getting shot at. I'm tired of getting raped. It's my best option right now for me. I mean, it says as a society, you know, we're failing people. We're failing a group of people, whether it's via housing, whether it's via, you know, employment opportunities, training opportunities, you know, mm-hmm. one woman in particular, at the wrong place at the wrong time when the murder occurred, you know, but she was there and culpable. You know, drugs played a part in that. And another one was just the case that you said. It was a husband that was abusive. You know, but, you know, to kill somebody when they're sleeping isn't looked upon so nicely. Yep, there were a couple people like that. One young lady became my friend now. She ended up being from Baltimore. We actually ended up finding out we lived not too far from each other as children. And she actually was the person who took over teaching the class that I had developed after I left, because she had a little bit more time, and we're still friends to this day. There was another older woman that kind of took me under her wing and, you know, shared some important things that I needed to know and know what to do and what not to do. I remember the first night, like, I cried. I never slept in a bunk bed before. And so I was on this top bunk up high on this concrete floor. And I'm like, Lord, did you send me here to die? Because if I roll over on this floor, I'm going to die. And so I slept in this, like, you know, coma, whatever position, and didn't move all night. So that was stressful. But yeah, I did. I motivated people, because after that, it was like, I can't mope about this. Like, I'm here for these 15 months. I got to make the best of it. I can't get in any trouble. So, like, focus, girl. And so that's when I just said, I'm going to work out every day. I'm going to, you know, do what I can do. And then Holy Spirit told me about the teaching the class thing, because I was definitely not thinking about that. But I ended up designing the class and it got approved. So the first thing I learned is trying to look at the clock. You have to be conscious of time, because you have to be certain places, like meal time, and, you know, you had to get up a certain time. But I focused on the seasons, right? The seasons and holidays. Right. I got to do one Christmas. I got to do one Easter. I got to do, you know, that. But other than that, I didn't focus on time. I didn't much think about it. Like, I didn't think about the time until I had, like, what they say, I got 5 days in a wake up. Like, 5 days from your release, that's kind of when you start counting. I'm going to say it didn't fail me because I'll just say this. I went in with skills, right? Like, I was already a professional. I already had a job. I already had a career. So I didn't need to be taught those things. But there were clearly women in there who didn't have a resume, hadn't worked before, didn't know, you know, a lot. And so that's why I say it starts at it. You know, rehabilitation starts at incarceration. The day you get incarcerated, you need to be working on your plan, your personal development plan for you when you eventually get out. And they don't do that. And then I forgot to say, like, the healthcare system is totally whack. I saw women die while I was there for menial stuff. I had a situation where I could have died. I don't know. There was like a nurse and there were doctors there, you know, at the medical unit, but it was almost like you couldn't get anything for pain, like other than Tylenol, because I guess they don't want you to get addicted or try to sell it. But like I had a boil, right? An abscess due to stress. And so they like lanced it with like no topical numbing cream or anything. And it was in a very sensitive area of my body. And mm-hmm. they just packed it and sent you away and said, come back tomorrow, get some Tylenol from the commissary. I think that healing process happened, you know, as a result of me getting prepared to go to prison. And then while I was there, I spent some time, you know, journaling and praying and, you know, forgiving myself. And I asked all of the people that were closest to me to forgive me. And I had individual conversations with them to do that. And I think, you know, my life now, the work that I do and am dedicated to do until God takes me away from here, is helping people, helping young people, telling my story. I probably need to write a book, but I don't feel like writing, but, you know, sharing, you know, knowledge is important. And if my story could help somebody else not do what I did, that matters to me. And so, you know, but I also understand why people commit crime because of why I did it. Like, and for people to say it was a book, I forget the author, but it's called Why Good People Do Bad Things. Like, I read that book. Like, it's a real thing. Like, I'm a good person. I didn't get that money and buy fancy cars and Louis Vuitton bags. I was like, you know, I helped other people. I helped myself, you know, my family, but it definitely wasn't, you know, like I have all this money and I'm just going to floss with it. No, it wasn't like that at all. Right now I work for an organization called, can you see my shirt? It's called ROCA Baltimore. ROCA stands for rock in Spanish. That's it. And it's a nonprofit organization that started out in Boston, Massachusetts. We have 5 sites there and we work with the critically high risk young men. And what we call a high risk young man is our young men in Baltimore who are shooters and shooting victims, our young men in Baltimore who are not ready, willing, or able to go to any other program or to sit in a classroom and go to school. I am the community and special projects manager at ROCA, and I help all of our young people. Right now, we have 154 young men that are eligible and enrolled in our program. I'll just say that. Between the ages of 16 and 24 is the young the ages of the young men we work with. The average age of our young person is 21. It's just phenomenal to see them grow. We have a transitional employment program where they work. We have a contract with Department of Planning and Department of Public Works. And so they do line of sight work, landscaping and all of that 4 days a week. And then one day in the classroom with us learning. But the premise of our program is that the brain can change over time. And all of these young people have challenges with trauma and they have faced trauma and they are working with a lot of challenges, right? Mm-hmm. And some of them are walking around, not that they want to shoot people, that they're carrying guns and weapons because they want to protect themselves because they are fearful that their life, that someone is going to attack them. Mm-hmm. And so when ROCA came to Baltimore, we've been here 3 years now, 2.5, 3 years. And most of the staff, except for one person, is all hired from Baltimoreans. People, other organizations in the city were like, you guys, we have other people that are doing this work. We're working with young people. And I would challenge them. And I would say, you know what? It's enough love to go around for all of our young people, but you don't work with these people. And I'm going to tell you why. I said, if a young person comes into your program and they spit on you and pull a knife on you, what are you going to do? And so they would often say, we're going to call the police. We're going to have them arrested. And I was like, yeah, well, that's a broken kid. And we're not going to do that. We're going to wipe the spit off and we're going to walk with them and we're going to have a conversation. We're going to take the knife and we're going to figure out what that was about. And that's a true story that really happened in our first year. I think that it's the economy. It's the, you know, inability for people to provide for their families and their children. You know, a woman doesn't want to prostitute herself. She's prostituting herself because of either drugs, someone's making her do it, or she needs some money. Mm-hmm. I think that's not a career that you wake up and say, ha, I'm going to sell my body to make some money. You know, that's not happening today in 2021. No, it's not. I didn't run into, you know, I didn't have any fights or altercations like that while I was incarcerated. I saw some, but I wasn't a part of any. So when you first get there, they put everybody in this big dorm. Oh my God, just think of like a military dorm with all of the bunks open and there are like not many walls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Little cubbies, but then it was overcrowded. So they called it the bus stop where it was just wide open bunks, right? So no privacy. You would change in the bathroom stall. And it got really hot. When I first got there, it was summertime and all of the windows were nailed shut. And so they had the big military fan. So there were two times in my life that I was hungry and extremely hot to the point where I felt like I was going to pass out. And that was all while I was in prison. Mm-hmm. And so one of my friends was like, you wanted to be a bougie prisoner. You're in prison. That's what you get. I'm like, no, I have a right to be treated humanely. I am a human being, right? Tax dollars pay. We pay money for people to be incarcerated. If I'm going to mistreat somebody while they're incarcerated, how do you think they're going to want to treat people when they come out? They're going to be mad angry. So we in there and they had thermometers in there. And I remember the thermometer being at 115 degrees. Okay, so there's a fan that's going to cool you off, right? Then you had to buy a fan. So that means you had to have money for your family to send you. Everything in commissary was marked up 55%. Again, it should be illegal. The prison system is doing more illegal shit, excuse my French, than half of the criminals on the street. And so here you are in prison trying to advocate and do all this for them to make it right. And then they, you know, no sooner than you write somebody outside, they start lying on the inside and making it like it's right. Right? And, you know, when I came home, went to the doctor, I was severely deficient in vitamin D, which is a little abnormal, but and vitamin E and just all kinds of stuff because of the food that you eat, right? So there weren't a lot of fresh vegetables there. You know, there wasn't a salad bar and, you know, it was overcooked stuff, canned stuff, just not healthy. So again, if we're saying, you know, people are going to get released, don't we want them to be healthy? Don't we want them to be able to thrive when they get home? No, you want them to be sick and not work, and then you can't live off a disability if you've never worked. Like, it's a cyclical cycle of poverty. And so I knew a young lady that worked in the kitchen, and so we would get contraband from her because she would get us peppers and lettuce and vegetables, and I'd put them under my sweatshirt and jog back up and hide it, right? Because if you get caught with it, you get a ticket, you get a write-up for vegetables, because I just want some fresh vegetables. And so my intention, like I said, before I went in, I did some mental preparation, some spiritual preparation. And I was like, I'm not going to let it beat me. I'm not going to kill myself. I am not going to let somebody, you know, take advantage of me or make me think I have to be their girlfriend. And I'm not going to, You know, I'm just not going to do it. First day I got there again, you know, I've had some good privilege in my life. I haven't lived in poverty. I didn't live, you know, I lived a good life. My family raised me well. I have no complaints about that. I wasn't poor, right? We weren't poor. We needed some stuff, but we weren't poor.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in a population with people who have nothing. So I come in, I got commissary. My commissary money is stacked. When I first went, I bought fan, food. I was good. So then people wanted to be my friend. So you had to peep that out. And somebody had to come and tell me, don't buy all your stuff at one time. Stop. Spread it out. Because you don't want people coming for you. So at that point, she was pretty grown, right? I turned 40 while I was incarcerated. So my daughter's 16 years younger than me. So y'all do the math. She had a child of her own. My grandson might have been 2. So she came to visit me once, but it was just sad for her. You know, she always looked up to her mom, so she was pretty shocked when it happened. You know, and I had to do really big, you know, apology with her. But yeah, it didn't break it. She didn't resent me. She still, you know, very much respects me to this day and honors all the things that I've done, good and bad. Making sure that you are prepared financially. And like somebody really talks to you about your finances and how to manage finances, because it can get overwhelming with a child. And I remember my mother making it look so easy. And I remember going to the store with her, and I would call her the $100 dress lady, because every dress when we would go shopping, she'd get would be $100. So I was just like, oh, okay, that's what you do. You buy $100 dresses. Okay. You know, there was not that conversation. Right. And so I had to figure it out. And like I said, you know, I went to college late in life. So by that time, all that damage was done. It was done. It was in my head about money. Like, yeah, I can do this. I can do that. But saving and investing and all that wasn't the conversation. I wanted a crab cake. I just wanted some. I wanted some potato salad and some greens. So, yeah. So, but then you don't go straight home. You have to go to the halfway house. It's required. So you had to go in the halfway house. And oh my God, how could I forget this? The halfway house was worse than prison, y'all. And so there were men in some of the rooms and then the women. Oh, it was the, why would you put, I was so afraid. They were going to come in the room and rape me. It was the worst. But at night, you had to show a part of your body. So you couldn't cover your head, right? Like with your blanket. So imagine like a light that is on all night, right? It's a light in the dorm that's on. So I couldn't cover the blanket. So I had this eye mask. So I made a crochet eye mask. So I had my eye mask on. My arms hanging out so you can see me. But they would come by and take their baton or whatever and bang it on your bed. Like you're sleeping. You see I'm in the bed. Why are you banging? So imagine being in a deep sleep, like, and somebody banging on you at your head, and you wake up, you're on the top bunk. Like, do you really have to do that? Is that really necessary? No. If I wake up and I punch you, then I'm going to get in trouble. So it was that. That ended up being traumatic for me. Like when I got home, you know, different things as I was sleeping, I would wake up and I would be like, where am I? Kind of thing like that. And that, you know, so yeah, it was stuff like that. That was not, I was like, that's not right. There was a toilet paper shortage one time. It was terrible. It was just terrible. I was like, what? I don't expect a Ritz Carlton, but I expect basic necessities, toilet paper and some disinfectant. Like, come on. I didn't come to prison to die.
Right.
I didn't come to prison to die. Like, I'm punished. I lost my freedom. Like, you don't have to treat me like trash. I'm not trash. I remember this guard down in the education building. And she said to me one day, why are you always smiling? Why are you so happy? You're in prison. I said, oh, I said, and I'm happy. I said, but I'm going to get released from here one day. You're still going to be here. I'm going to be happy. I ain't had time to be depressed. I went to the psychiatrist one time. I did go. And I talked to the lady, and I think I helped her more than she helped me. In any profession, people can get jaded, right? Jaded over time, meaning you really don't necessarily see the good or the value in what you're doing. It's just rote. You're just doing it to be doing it, right? And so I've experienced a lot of people who have worked in reentry or work with people, parole agents, you know, prison guards, you know, you're going to be back, nurses, you're gonna come back and have another baby. So this very jaded mindset, right? I just think that, you know, people have to do, you have to do a lot of self-care. When you're doing human service work, you have to stay grounded in, why am I doing this? I'm not doing this because I feel sorry for the young boys, black boys in Baltimore City. That's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I know that they deserve better, because I know that they can do better given the opportunity and the tools. I don't feel sorry for them because they're doing the best that they can with what they have, right? They don't know what they don't know, right? So to hear a young man say, you know what, Miss Andre, nobody ever told me they love me. Nobody ever asked me, how am I doing? Do I need anything? Do I want a snack? But again, some were with different family members. And so the challenge again is there, if you don't have money to use the phone, because it costs to use the phone in prison. Yeah. Now I have internet. I didn't have that while I was there. But if you don't have money to talk to your kids, how are you going to continue that relationship? How are you going to support if that, you know, how do you do that? And so that was a big deal for some women when they didn't have enough money to last a month to talk, you know, to their kids. And it was just hard for them, heartbreaking for them. My daughter was grown, you know, she was 20 years old. So I didn't have to do that as much. I rode her and I did different things, but I couldn't imagine having a young child. Like that's hard. No, I remember a job that I had after I'd been home. I was working with a men's reentry program, and I would have to go into the prison to see the men and meet with them. And so when I first went back, I was like, oh, shit. Like, woo. It brought it back then. But that was it. And then I got to the point where I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to see that because it was so sad and depressing where they were and how they were. It was different from the federal prison. Like Hagerstown is just different. It's different. You dress. It's just different. But yeah, there are certain jobs, like I didn't have any restrictions. Sometimes when you get certain federal charges, they will say you can never do such and such and such and such. So I didn't have that restriction. But answering the criminal background question, if you're asked that, you know, I teach people to be honest, and the employer has a right to know. So you need to answer the question. I teach people how to answer that question properly because there is a way to do it. And that's it. It's something that now, you know, I'm not proud of it, but it is an experience that has made me a better person. And at the end of the day, I learned from it. And like I said, it's not something that I'll ever do again. But I can definitely relate to people who have done what I did. And I have a better understanding of it.